to the Data Points podcast, where we discuss all things government and data. I'm your co-host, Sharon Paley. Thanks for joining us this episode as we take a look at improvement science. To find out what this is, among other things, we talked to three people from BERC, which is the Baltimore Education Research Consortium.
And I'm your other co-host, Eric Reese. This week, GovX Director of Applied Research, Catherine Klosik, and I had a great conversation with Faith Connolly, the Executive Director of BERC, Mark Stein, an Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins, and Jared Bolte, the founder of a nonprofit called Improving Education. We talk with them about a variety of items related to how they do improvement science and how they implement a lot of work with data in Baltimore's public schools.
So let's turn it over to Kat and Eric at the interview.
Thanks to everyone for joining us. We're really happy to have you all on today to talk about improvement science and a variety of other things. But what I thought we could do to kick things off is for all of you that are on the line, just to introduce yourselves so we can hear who you are and then go from there with really great discussion for the rest of the time.
Hi, my name is Jared Bolte. I am the founder of Improving Education.
Hi, Faith Connolly. I'm the executive director of the Baltimore Education Research Consortium, or BERC.
I'm Mark Stein, associate professor at Johns Hopkins School of Education and also the research co-director of BERC.
And this is Kat Klosik, director of applied research here at GovX. And I'm going to kick it off with the first question. So thank you all for joining us. If you don't mind, can you start out by just defining improvement science? Talk a little bit about what it means and how it can be useful.
So it's really hard to, I could spend probably about 3 hours explaining improvement science, so I'll make it really.
Yeah, shorter, please.
Improvement science is really a way of doing work that looks at existing conditions and programs or bodies of work and looks to both improve what exists there and also iterate on different changes that we could possibly put in place that would result in an improvement in outcomes that we're trying to improve. So a lot of our work that I've been doing with our schools has been around improving early literacy outcomes. So it's a challenge that nationwide we're trying to tackle, but we've been working small, very fast with a small group of schools who are testing out different changes and iterating those ideas into something that we could scale to support other schools in the future.
And if I could add a little bit on that, I think from a research perspective and someone who's worked with school districts, a lot of times data in education is used for accountability purposes only. And people have a very negative, defensive reaction to data. And what improvement science does is it changes that lens. It makes someone look at data as something that empowers me to do my job better. It's smaller pieces of data that are more meaningful to me that I probably collect on my own and allows me to become involved in the process and own it myself rather than be looking at someone else's test scores. And that brought a lot of excitement to the research part from our side.
Yeah, that's a really helpful summary. And I'm just curious, since you all are working in education, is this something that's specific, you know, in its application more to the education field, or is it something that is much more broadly applied in terms of government work or other types of disciplines?
Yeah, it's actually more broadly applied. It's actually a relatively new concept in education. There's probably 25 to 30 years of work in improvement science, also termed quality improvement in healthcare. So hospitals who are trying to reduce infection rates or trying to cure different diseases are many times using these same principles of improvement science to tackle those problems. And you know, I feel like education is finally getting to the place where we're beginning to see that in order to improve the outcomes at scale, we're going to have to do things a little differently. We're not going to just implement a program and it's going to get those outcomes. We have to understand the conditions that exist at the school sites, within districts, within cities. And that same type of knowledge or application, I feel, could also be applied at the city level or community level in tackling problems that may be existing in different communities.
Great. Thank you. You know, we've heard a lot about different fields like, behavioral science and human-centered design making their way into government decision-making. Is improvement science related to those fields? Can you talk a little bit about that, or is it kind of its own niche?
Yeah, it's definitely related, kind of a cousin. With a lot of the human-centered design, the focus is on designing the solution with the knowledge of people who are closest to the problem. Improvement science does that as well, except there's an additional layer on there and a structure really focused on the model for improvement and something called a PDSA cycle. So the model for improvement really asks three questions. What are we trying to accomplish? What changes can we make that will result in an improvement? And then how do we know that that change is an improvement? So adding that data piece in there. And then a PDSA cycle is actually a cycle that we use to rapidly iterate on different changes that we think will result in improvement. So plan something, do it, measure that effect, study those impacts, and then act or iterate within a new cycle. And these things can happen, you know, sometimes daily, weekly, monthly, depending on the size of the change or the tests that we're trying to put in place or kind of understand what are the conditions that are at play.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And that sounds very similar to a lot of the work that we do with governments. And Mark, I'm curious just to hear your thoughts as well on how BIRC has implemented these kind of PDSA cycles and just improvement science in general with a focus on educational outcomes.
Right. So I think for us, or I'll speak for myself, getting engaged with the concept of improvement science probably about 5 or 6 years ago, it resonated with me because, it, as Jared just explained, the PDSA cycle, that sounds a lot like the scientific method. It sounds a lot like the research methods classes we teach, you know, like here at Hopkins and every other institution. But it brings with it this other piece of really engaging on the ground in doing the work, and not just doing the work, but also the sense making. So what is our problem? How do we know that's a problem? What do we think is going to work? And not just stating that we think it's going to work, but giving some reasons, giving some, a rationale for that, but then ultimately bringing some data to that judgment call that the practitioner is going to make. So it's not just sufficient to say, oh, that didn't work. We then follow that up quickly with, it doesn't work because of these things that I observed and noted in my own data or in my own practice as an observer. And, you know, we saw that in working. I'm going to back up a step, actually. So wonderful ideas, really digestible on from both the practitioner side, and as a researcher, I can also see the research process in that. Then the question becomes, well, how do we go do this? How do we get this to work in a school? And I know Jared's been working down in the weeds, so to speak, of that, trying to get it done. And that's the non-trivial part of this, is figuring out how do we introduce a faculty, a group of practitioners in a school to these concepts, which I would argue they kind of intuitively understand and probably do elements of it already. But how do we get them to engage with it in a way that allows it to reproduce itself within the group, so that it's a way of being and a way of approaching problems in schools? And that's an intriguing question. There's a lot of work to figure that out. As Jared said, medicine's been doing it for, you know, a couple decades, and so they've kind of figured out how to get people to take up the tools. And I think we're really at that space where I said to some folks at the Carnegie Foundation who have been real champions of this process, as we started getting engaged, and we were kind of into some frustration of, gosh, how do we get this done? And I asked them, how do you get this done in you know, public schools? How do you get this done on the ground? And they said, when you figure it out, let us know. And so I think that's kind of where we're at. I think we're figuring parts of it out. But ultimately, there's a lot of promise here for changing practice.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, I think there's, you know, Mark talked about kind of, we've been focused on what works and trying to replicate what works. This goes deeper to ask the question of, we really want to figure out what works with whom under what conditions. And those last two of with whom under what conditions are really the struggles of any local jurisdiction, any school system, any organization who's trying to solve problems. We have the general knowledge and research about what might work, but we don't know how to do it on the ground, and that's where improvement science really kicks in. It allows us to be nimble and flexible, but back it up with data, and really get changes from the end user, from teachers, from school leaders, understanding what may be at play and what changes can we make that result in these improvements.
Thank you, guys. That's great. And now, so I think Faith started out by talking about helping people think differently about data. You've all mentioned data as a key aspect of this process. Can you talk a little bit more about kind of some of the data points and data sources that have come up through your improvement science work, especially in Baltimore City?
One of the ones I think that we started with that the way it all rolled out really quite surprised us. It was, we were working with a high school that had a high chronic absence rate. And when we talked with the leaders and the practitioners, they said, well, one of the problems is we have a lot of kids skipping classes. So we said, well, why don't we think about how we would stop that? And so one of the suggestions one of the administrators have is, let's do hall sweeps. We'll just come to the hall, grab all the kids, put them in a room, we'll have an Excel spreadsheet, and we'll sign them in. Great idea. So they ran their first hall sweep. They had so many kids in the room, they couldn't get the data entered in the class period time, so they decided to change the way they were going to staff the room, and then they had their second sweep a couple of days later. This time, the number of kids wasn't cut in half. Data entry was a whole lot easier. They did follow-ups with teachers, and they had follow-through happen up for all the kids that got put on the spreadsheet. After a couple of weeks, we went in for a meeting, and they said, we failed. The experiment has completely failed. Every time we do a sweep in the hallway now, no one's there. And we kind of smiled. We said, no, that was an awesome experiment. You thought you had an intervention. It did exactly what you wanted to do. And then as we're talking, they described what actually happened was the kids who were not highly likely to skip went back to their classrooms, and they were getting instruction. Kids who were definitely there not for their classrooms and not to be in instruction moved out off campus so that they could do other activities and be social and do what they wanted to do. And I think that thinking about how we think about our work that way is very, very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's really two levels of data here. So in the work that we're doing around early literacy and improving those outcomes, one is using existing measures that already exist, but using them in a different way. So we currently have data that we're capturing 3 times a year on students' proficiency in certain reading skills. And we get nice, pretty reports that report out kids who are green, yellow, and red. Green kids are great. Yellow kids, we need to do something. Red kids are, whoa, they're pretty far behind. We have a danger of them failing. So they're indicators. But when we started digging into the data and looking at what were the smaller data points, what were the measures that were rolling up to those green, yellow, red, and began using those to group kids, to understand the profile of a kid who is that color and what it might mean for instruction, then it changed the whole conversation around we need to do something to what is the exact thing that we should be doing. And it helped us to then design better instruction, design better tests that were tailored to the students' needs and be able to measure then those improvements as we progress monitored and as the next round of data came in. So that's really the existing data, and data like attendance and other things, suspension data, all kind of rolls into that as painting a picture for those students. But secondary to this is that data that comes out of PDSA cycles. And it's as simple as, did the intervention work the way we thought it was going to work? What data were we capturing daily around even like groups meeting or kids coming to school or the instructions that the teacher thought they were going to deliver actually being delivered? So this process data actually helped us. This is new data that's being generated through this work, actually helped us to look at the progress and tie it to the change that we were making. So really those two levels of data are important, and most of the time we're just using the high level, but these smaller process data points are extremely important, even to Faith's conversation earlier about the attendance and kind of what they were doing, which gave them insight into their system and into how they could re-engineer that system in a different way.
And I would just add to highlight that schools are massive data generating machines. There is a lot of data that is produced inside of schools every day. It's not necessarily recorded, and some is, and it's rolled up into all of these different kinds of metrics that we might commonly see about schools. I mean, I think one of the lessons we learned early on, there was some frustration of, well, how do we use this kind of aggregate data or data that might have another initial purpose? And I think Jared's highlighted and Faith has highlighted that those are usable, but we have to think about how do we use them? At what point do we use them? And I think another way is also thinking creatively about how we might use data. So we can use historical data. One thing I like doing is doing thought experiments with teams and saying, well, what if? What is a change that if we actually achieved it would make us all, you know, raise our hands and say we really did something this year? And then using historical data and doing these kinds of thought experiments of, well, what if we gave every single kid an extra day of attendance every month? What would our end of the year chronic absentee rate look like? And, you know, maybe surprising to some, you would dramatically change those numbers by doing something simple, I'm saying in quotes, of getting a day a kid. And, you know, the practitioners, people on the ground can say, oh, I think we can chip away at that versus, oh, you've got 60% of your kids missing 20 or more days. That's a huge problem. But when you use historical data and a thought experiment, you can break it down to something that, hey, if we just get one more day a month, we can really make a difference. And I think it's being flexible in using data in multiple different places is really a key driver in this process.
Yeah, so being able to see data in a different way and seeing that the change that we have to make is not a full year change. We don't have to improve the outcomes of kids who are a year and a half, 2-3 years below, as reported by the data, and get them on grade level. It's what do we do next week to move the needle this one little step?
Yep.
And then if we can compound that over time and we continue with these cycles, we're actually setting up those small changes that teachers or administrators or school district personnel see as manageable. And then it actually also builds buy-in to the process and doing the work.
And it's I despise that I use sports analogies a lot, but it's like I'll take singles from every batter versus the occasional home run. And that's really a mind shift. And a way of approaching the work that really can drive the work and improvement.
And I just want to add one last thing. It's like as we've noticed in all of our teams, as they're moving through the improvement work, they find new problems that they never actually had the opportunity to sort of crystallize and understand better. So it's sort of you solve one problem, you can just naturally, the next one just sort of pops out of the data and you can start working on that.
Yeah, well, Mark, I know that you're going the opposite way of the baseball analytics these days. So it's but I'm also kind of piggybacking a little bit on what you all have talked about in terms of it being a process that generates, you know, additional insight. How do you all get started with this? And I know, Mark, you mentioned a little bit about the thought exercises, but I think we spend a lot of time with our partners thinking about problem identification and really structuring issues for analysis. How do you all do that within your own work and more broadly within improvement science just to get the ball rolling?
So we went into this really naively thinking, isn't this a great idea? Everyone's going to see it. When we were started to work with our first high school, that first year was all about trust building. We ran data reports for him. We ran different sort of things for him, but we were continually having to rebuild that trust that we weren't there to nail him. We weren't going to go tell someone the data looks like this or that. But that someone could then go through that mindset shift of saying data can be my friend, data can help me improve. That literally took us probably even 18 months, not even a year, to get to that space where that could happen. And I found that one of the most challenging parts of the work, to just keep on going and keep trying to figure it out. And I think as the process was happening, we were thinking we're not doing this right. Looking back now, I think it just takes that long to build that trust and that space to work in.
Yeah, and that work that you have to do with the personnel to build the trust is really important, because this is a whole other way of doing work. It's not about implementing a program. It's about really kind of trying out different things and being open and honest about what we're seeing on the ground as a result of that. But to your point earlier, there's still a whole layer of doing the kind of the problem space analysis, the understanding what is the root cause behind this outcome and really understanding what all the things that may be at play. And then identifying really key drivers. So what are the 5 to 6 things that if we were to improve these areas, that we would improve the outcome that we're expecting to improve? And then also beginning to get into the space of not just putting data in place to measure the outcome and the outcome change, but also each one of those key drivers. How do we know that if we do work in this area, that there's an improvement in the data that's associated with each of those drivers?
In your question's a really good one, because often the problem that we might present as the problem we're going to work on is going to need time and unpacking, because that may be too big to even remotely think we're going to tackle that, you know. And naturally, I think we tend to fixate or focus on these massive problems. So chronic absenteeism is a massive problem that has many associated potential causes, but can we peel that back down to manageable sizes so that we can actually attempt to see the root causes that we think are happening? And it's finding that it's right sizing the problem is a really important part of the work.
Yep. And the tool of a driver diagram is something that we'd use to organize that. And we also slap the label on there that says possibly wrong and definitely incomplete. So I think what we're doing with improvement science work is both trying to solve that problem, but then also learn about the system that's producing it. And then, so many times when we're going into this, even though we've done all the problems analysis and kind of have a good sense of what's happening and have identified the key drivers, as we start doing work, other information might come up that we never thought about, and it's just highlighted very clearly in doing some of that work.
Great. Thank you guys so much. I think just one more question before we wrap up. If folks want to read a little bit more about improvement science or learn more about your work, what are some resources or some places that they can look?
So one of the organizations who's really been at the forefront of this is the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. They also have recently published a book called Learning to Improve that talks about how America's schools can get better at getting better. But I think they're one of the main researchers. We've also done some work with them.
Especially in the education space.
Yeah.
And then from the health sector...
Yeah, from the health sector, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement has really been leading this work for the last 30 years and have really taken from what was also business practices of improvement and you know, improving the line in a factory to applying that to the healthcare space. And IHI has been at the forefront of that work.
And should we mention Deming as the father of improvement science? So, yeah, it's even that far back, yeah.
Don't read this book.
Except
yes,
yeah.
Well, it's hard for us to go a day without a Deming reference. I hear you there. That's all good. But thank you all so much for joining us today. I think it's been really great discussion, and I've certainly learned a lot, and I know that we'll have a lot to share with our partners. So thanks again, and we look forward to talking more soon.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks again to Faith, Mark, and Jared, and also Catherine, for being on this week's podcast. If you like what you heard or have comments about this or any other GovX podcast, please leave us a message on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to the podcast. Also, be sure to follow GovX at GOV_EX on Twitter and Instagram.
Thanks, as always, for listening, and join us again soon to find out where the data points.